Thank you, dear listener, for tuning in to Panopticon, a podcast which explores various elements of the occult, culture, and consciousness. And now your host, Andy.
So we are back on Panopticon Podcast, part two of our interview with Christopher O'Brien, talking about his excellent must-read book, Stalking the Tricksters, Shapeshifters, Skinwalkers, Dark Adepts, and 2012. And, so...
Y2012K.
Okay, let's talk about that. What are your thoughts on 2012? And the hype surrounding it, I guess.
Well, you have to look at it from two distinct paths. One is the pop culture program view, which, to me, I'm just aghast. I can't believe some of the hyperbole and hubris that I'm seeing. I mean, it was, 2 years ago, I was watching a documentary on 2012 on the History Channel, and they had the audacity, I couldn't believe this, to say the Maya, who went extinct in the 1300s and then were wiped out by the Spanish in the 1600s, are an extinct people. And it's like, I mean, if you just did a little bit of research, you would find that the Maya are the largest single group of indigenous Americans.
Right.
I mean, it's like, there's like 3 million Maya. Right. And you're saying that they went extinct? It's like, and then you hear, this one I love. The Mayan calendar is going to end on December 21st, 2012. And, depending on the version, we're all going to die or we're going to transform. Okay, first of all, a rhetorical question. When does our calendar end?
It doesn't.
Calendars don't end.
Right.
You know, they say the Mayan calendar. You know how many Mayan calendars there are?
Right.
I think I've counted up to 19. They have calendars for everything. The human gestation cycle, that's one of my favorite calendars. That's how they determine your individual person glyph, for instance. It's ludicrous to me that people are being fed this pop culture streamlined BS version of this very important 2 year, 3 year period that we're going into. No question, some major, I mean, it's already happening. Major things are coming down, and I'll be the first one to admit to that particular feeling. But there are three major cycles of the Mayan calendar that are clicking over. They're completing their rotation. They're going back to zero. That's what's going on here. We have three cycles being completed. And the most important one is the long count. From my research and based on my limited understanding, from what I get is we've gone in 26,000 years all the way around the galaxy. The solar system has done a complete revolution of the galaxy. Now, I'm sure somebody will correct me here if I'm wrong, but that long count calendar is switching over. We're at the end of the 13th Bakhtun. At the same instant, we also have the end of a 50-year cycle calendar, or cycle, rather, and I think a 3,200-year or 3,100-year cycle. Uh-huh. This is unprecedented. We've never had all these three cycles ending together. So, in answer to your question, we're living the curse of the Chinese curse. May you live in interesting times.
Right.
And if I had to pick and choose what time to be in, I would be right now. We're going to see some amazing stuff go down in the next few years.
The trickster element right here, my clock just turned to 11:11. As soon as you said the word what time I would pick, it just went to 11:11. That's funny. But
I rest my case.
Yeah, there we go. Let's see. You mentioned so many different interesting creatures and entities in Stalking the Tricksters. And, obviously...
thousands.
Yeah.
I cherry-picked. I love the Dila. That's one of my favorites. I always wondered why Filipino women wouldn't sit on the bamboo, the raised bamboo floors, the raised houses above the water level.
Uh-huh.
And you never see them in their skirts sitting on the floor. Well, come to find out, there's the Dila, and it's a paranormal tongue.
Oh, right.
And it comes up between the grooves in the bamboo and licks you.
Right.
And
licks you to death or something, right?
Now, if I was a Filipino woman in a skirt sitting on a bamboo floor, I would have to think twice about staying there for too long.
Yeah, right. Let's see. One of my favorite creatures that were mentioned in the book are these brownies, and specifically your story about your friend there who was had a music studio next to his house, and they,
His name, Jack Cookley. He's like one of the most famous keyboard players in the history of Hollywood.
Okay.
Yeah, he. I would have to digress quite a bit, but basically, in a nutshell, I identified a very specific spot where I feel there's the veil is thinnest. Like if you stretch taffy, the holes appear.
Yeah.
Let's say the holes are to another dimension or another realm of existence. There was one right behind his house. And all the neighbors in the area, you know, we're talking about a 3 or 4 square mile area. There were only 3 or 4 houses. But they all
had...
Again? This is in Colorado, in the Vaca Grande, in the San Luis Valley.
Okay.
And he bought this house, this great house. I became very friendly with him. He has, I think, 40 patents on innovations in music, including he has a patent on the electronic guitar.
Wow.
He was a chief consultant for Korg and for Roland. He helped, you know, the Sound Canvas, the famous module sound generator that came out in the late 80s, early 90s. He designed it. He has over 600 television and film credits. He played the famous theme in the Twilight Zone. He was on the original Star Trek, you know, with Lulu singing along with his homemade synthesizer. The guy has been there and back. Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. I mean, I could go on and on. TV shows, the Army, famous Army jingles. He's recording one day in his studio. He had been seen... I'd have to check my notes, but for the prior 2 or 3 months, he'd been seeing these weird undulating forms close to the ground that were zipping around him. He said over 90 to 100 times on a 2-3 month period. He'd been seeing these things in his peripheral vision, okay, and his dog would chase him. He knew it was something. There were no tracks, but he couldn't really get a fix on what it was.
Right.
So he's in his studio, which is a separate building from his house. It's, you know, just about 50 feet away from the house, and middle of the day, and out of the wall or out of the door without it opening comes trooping fairies. He wasn't sure how many. I think about five to seven, and they went in a straight line right in front of him and out the wall. And he said the last one, as just about he was about to leave the wall, he looked back at him and kind of like gave him a sniff, you know, like, oh, you know, what are you doing here? And phoop, they went right out the wall. Now, you know, your average person calling me and reporting something like this, I would sit up and take notice, but the fact that it was Jack Cookley just blew my mind. The guy is, I forget at the time, he was 70, I think he was a 5th or 6th degree black belt in karate, extremely illuminated individual. He didn't get on the famous airline crash in Chicago at O'Hare in 1979. He was booked on the flight. He has the ticket in a frame with the newspaper article of the crash on his wall.
Wow.
Very tuned in guy. Extremely amazing guy. He was very instrumental in inspiring me as a musician, as a fellow keyboard player as well. And for someone like that had nothing to gain by admitting that he was having these experiences. And he said, Chris, look, you know, I really hesitate telling you this, but I know I honor what you're doing, I support it, and you should know that this happened to me. And I have countless reports. He even went on the show Sightings and talked about this incredible UFO sighting that he and a dozen other people had in the area. We had nightly activity from 93 through 99. I mean, it was... There was a six and a half year period where I got as many as 17 calls in one day reporting mainly UFO sightings. We had over 200 cattle mutilation cases. You know, I really think there's something going on in the San Luis Valley. I think the powers that be have done as good a job as possible keeping a lid on it so that people in the world don't know what's going on there. But this is a paranormal playground, and I feel our government or some aspect quasi-governmental knowledge is utilizing whatever it is that's there, if it's a gateway, a portal, a window. I mean, the Indians talk about, you know, the moving place where thought emerges in the Dene tradition. It's Sisnagini, the Black Sash Medicine Belt, huh. Where all thought emerges. And, you know, I get into that.
Wait,
you know,
what is
Mysterious Valley?
Where all thought emerges, is that a particular geographical place or kind of like
more of a liminal state? It's a 60-mile stretch from Blanca Peak to Crestone Peak in the Sangre de Cristo Mountain.
Wow. Yeah, I haven't read your other book, so that's interesting. So it's kind of like where the veil between this world and other worlds is thin.
Exactly, but it's not a static doorway. And this is what really, really excited me when I finally got validation from the official, unofficial custodian of Sisnagini for the Dene was living in my community, and I, after knowing him 3 years and working with him, and I, you know, I was a nosy white boy, and you know, he was very, very close to the vest, very secretive, but I was able to finally get him to acknowledge that there, number one, was some sort of portal. I thought it was on Blanca Peak or somewhere in the Blanca Peak area, which is the sacred mountain of the east for, you know, all your southwestern Indians. Mount Taylor, the sacred mountain of the south, the San Francisco Peaks, the most important mountain for the Hopi, is, you know, right up the hill from me here in Flagstaff, and then Mount Hesperus in, you know, western central Colorado is sacred mountain of the north. But I lived at the place, the first cardinal mountain, the one where everything manifests into reality, and there's some sort of a doorway or gateway that goes back into the traditional knowledge of the Tewa, the San Carlos, all the pueblos down the Rio Grande have this very interesting legend about this being the place where you go to vision quest, you go to, you know, to gather your sacred objects, you go to do your spiritual work, find yourself spiritually in the San Luis Valley area. It's the only area that overlapped three regional groups of Native Americans. Not many people know that. The San Luis Valley was used by three major regional groups of Indians. There is no other spot in America that can claim that. The Great Basin Indians, you know, the Plains Indians, all the Pueblo peoples, the Southwestern Indians, they all kind of used that area. Nobody would live there, but they used it as a sacred hunting ground and vision quest area. And this, getting back to my point, this Navajo custodian who was there finally confessed to me that there was a doorway there, there was an opening. But what blew my mind is he says, it's not static, it moves. It can be anywhere in the 60-mile stretch. And I've been trying to pattern, you know, the hundreds of UFO sightings I've got and do straight line latitude projections, and it's pretty amazing some of the stuff that, you know, you can determine from data. Believe me. The bottom line is, though, that, you know, to cut to the chase, the trickster represents the causal and reactive force. It's the spark that turns the zero to the one in binary code.
Wow.
The trickster is the spark that creates change. And if you take that very basic definition and then pull it out, you know, into the modern world and into everyday life, it's amazing. You start to see patterning of coincidence, synchronicity. You see aberrant social behavior, unusual weather, outbreaks of paranormal phenomenon, paradigm shifting key events, 9/11, Orson Welles broadcast, Roswell.
Shit, I was just about to bring up 9/11 because I was reading, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I was reading your book and I was thinking, could such a spectacular, tragic event like 9/11, whether or not we want to say it was fabricated or not, could that be a tricksterish phenomenon?
It was definitely fabricated, my man. Those planes didn't fly into those buildings by accident.
All right. Well, I just mean, I'm of the persuasion that it wasn't.
I have a 50 megabyte, log of 9/11. It changed my life when it happened. It was really a very paradigm-shifting, almost psychically debilitating event.
Yeah.
I really feel that was when the powers that be showed us their true colors. To what lengths they were willing to go to get to where they are today.
Yeah.
And I have a really serious problem with the entrenched status quo and societal control mechanisms that are rock solid in place right now. I have a major problem with that. I'm an optimist. The glass isn't half full. It's not half empty. I'm going to fill it. So whatever I can do, I will do to bring people to a place where they can be open-minded enough to be inspired to do their own research and to find out things for themselves. We're living, like I said before, we're living the curse of may you live in interesting times. And it's too late, really, Andy, to preach to the unconverted. We have to solidify and organize with the people that really are on the ball and know what's going on.
Yeah.
And I think your podcast, and there's others out there, are really at the forefront of this vanguard. And really, you know, it's great to talk to somebody in Korea, and you sound like you're in the next room. This is so cool for me.
It's insane.
Yeah, so the Internet, basically, just to digress a little bit here, the trickster, his role has been to supply us with technology, right?
Yeah.
I mean, for thousands of years. Well, I think the trickster has become self-aware and has abdicated responsibility to bring us technology because we already got enough right now.
Yeah.
We're giving him technology.
Huh.
We are supplying the trickster with technology. What happens when the trickster, the Internet, believe me, the trickster's playground, sandbox right now.
Yeah.
Okay, just before we even say anything else. But what happens when the trickster gets into the Hadron Collider, CERN, or into the Human Genome Project?
Right.
What happens if the trickster, if it's not static, and if it's not, if it's not self-aware, if it is evolving and becoming self-aware, what happens if the trickster decides to create a physical manifestation of itself through the Human Genome Project?
Right.
Or gets into the Internet and becomes like Skynet, you know, in the Terminator movies. Remember Skynet when the global net becomes self-aware?
Right, right, right.
So I think we're supplying the trickster with technology right now. And I'm telling you, I think the next 2-3 years, and, you know, I stay away from two words. One begins with B, one begins with P. The B is belief. And the P is prophesize.
Okay.
I stay away from those two words like the plague. Believe any of this.
Yeah.
I don't believe any of this, okay? And I'm not prophesizing, but I would be willing to bet money that the next 3 years are going to be some of the most crucial, mind-blowing, shocking years in the history of mankind.
Yeah.
All this pop culture stuff about 9/11, or not 9/11, 2012.
Right.
Y2K, 9/11, 2012, they're all tied up in a neat little knot in my brain. All this pop culture programming around the subject of, the winter solstice in 2012 has tremendous power, because what we're doing is we're creating a self-fulfilling prophecy that we are, you know, who's to say if it was going to occur the way it's going to occur or not if we hadn't obsessed about it.
Sorry, I just have to mention, I really, really appreciate your perspective on this, because I've been watching all this phenomena, you know, on the glowing rectangular screen that I exist in front of for 4 to 6 hours a day, you know, looking at all these different websites and all these different commentators talking about 9/11. Some people are, it's all doom and gloom, and some people are, you know, think that after 2012 occurs, like, we're all going to be dancing around in circles with flowers in our hair. And we're going to be elevated beings.
New age transformation.
But I really...
You know what I think is going to happen? I love this theory. I forget who it was that suggested maybe 2012 is when we actually invent time travel. If you think about it, how can time travel exist prior to the point when it's invented?
Right.
I'm talking about physical time.
Right, right, right.
I'm a big fan of time as being a malleable... sort of eternal now. So, you know, when I think about paranormal stuff, for instance, I don't compartmentalize my thinking into anything in particular.
Yeah.
I try to allow all possibilities, and time travel is a big one. Us coming back from the future, to me, is beyond Hollywood. There's a ring to that.
Well, I just wanted to say that I really appreciate your attitude, your very vigorous skepticism, and acceptance of any and all possibilities regarding this 2012 thing, because I feel, looking at it, as if it's already been, like, dogmatized. Like, there's certain people out there who are major voices in the alternative media regarding this stuff who are already, like, basically saying what's going to happen, and they have no way of knowing what's going to happen. And they're, like, trying to tell other more submissive and malleable people. It's going to be this, it's going to be that. And it's like, man, the whole point of this thing is that we don't know. Like, all we know, as you said already, is that we're living in really interesting times, you know?
The amorphous we is one thing. We as a subculture, in terms of a westernized high-tech subculture, that we doesn't have a clue about the indigenous we. And if you talk to Mayan elders, timekeepers from Guatemala, like Don Alejandro, or Mayan elders, or Zuni elders, Grandfather Martin, Gashri Somo, other people, Clifford Mahudi from the Zuni, they have one rule of thumb, one piece of advice, basically, especially the Hopi and the Maya, and that is, it doesn't matter what happens from here on out. We're going to get through this. Some of us might not, but some of us will. But the one thing that I've noticed that seems to be consistent throughout this broad sort of Western Hemisphere idea, you know, coming from an elder, is that if the sun doesn't come up one day, lock your doors, shutter your windows, and no matter who comes to your door, do not let them in. That's what's consistent. And I was really amazed when Don Alejandro got up in front of a whole group here in Sedona, all the movers and shakers and all the true believers and even a bunch of skeptics and interested bystanders. He laughed. Basically his attitude was, like, you white, New Age white boys, you don't know what the hell's going on here. All this stuff, this change, it could have already happened. And maybe it's going to happen tomorrow or... maybe it's going to happen on 2012. Maybe it's going to happen 2013. He said, it doesn't matter. We're in the period when it's going to happen. There's no exact date when this stuff's going to go down. But if the sun doesn't come up, lock your doors, close your windows, do not let anybody in, no matter who they say they are. And that's the same thing the Hopi are saying.
Huh.
So, and another thing, too, is if you can, try to live above 4,000 feet in elevation.
Do they say that?
Yeah.
Wow.
The Maya definitely do. Martin said, just be close to Hopi. That was his. And they're at about 7,000 feet. So, he said, just be up here somewhere. I mean, he said basically the same thing. But the Maya definitely say, if you got to be at the altitude of San Cristobal, that area there, which is, I think, at about 4,000 feet. Anything below, you're taking your chances.
That almost seems to betray some kind of knowledge of what's to come in a way, you know?
No, not at all.
No.
No, they've known this for generations. It's fairly common knowledge down there if you ask. My brother lived down in Chiapas for 3 years, lived in Mexico for 5, set up the finest travel service to all the Mayan ruins that you can get into, and some that the public can't.
Oh, cool.
He has some of the finest, archaeologists and archaeoastronomers as his guides, and he's done a lot of really good legwork down there, and tuned me into some real, on the ground destination side knowledge, and the indigenous people, man, they look at this country and they chuckle, I mean, they've been there for hundreds, if not thousands of years, and they see us, just blazing across the, the reality in the last 100 years, 200 years, and they just got to chuckle and say, well, let's either hitch a ride on that rocket or try to maybe point it in the right direction or maybe just duck and cover, And it's great. That's one of the things that I really have been working on the last 10 years of my life is reconnecting with, indigenous knowledge, indigenous keepers of sacred knowledge, and if you can figure it out on a very basic archetypal level, then as above, so below, the Hermetic Axiom,
Trismegistus,
the Emerald Tablets, the Hermetic Axiom, as above, so below. If you could figure it out below, in the most primal, indigenous sort of the basic level where, entire books can be stated in one sentence, that sort of real primal level, it overlays perfectly all the way out into the macrocosm. The micro mirrors the macro, basically. And that's one thing, I really think that it's important that the blind spot in the Western world, which is its own esoteric tradition, and how it applies and it is being applied by the powers that be in this culture and in this time period. I think that's a really important and very relevant discussion point for shows like this.
Yeah, absolutely. And you just like nailed it. I think that in the West we've lost even our own tradition, which is to try to fuse the microcosm to the macrocosm, that we should always be aware of the fact that we are a part of each of us as individuals are kind of a universe unto ourselves, but that we should always be connected with all of the universes, everything that is at large, the macrocosm, and try to fuse ourselves into it in the most healthy and constructive and positive way possible, I guess. By whatever means.
From the heart. You know, from the heart. If it's from the heart, it can't go wrong. I mean, I think Crowley, you know, has a couple of axioms that I feel really illustrate what you're describing. And the first one is, every man and woman is a star.
Yep.
And that's important. And we're talking physical, cosmological star, we're talking astrological, we're talking spiritual, we're talking metaphoric. Every man and woman is a star. And that star has a particular
orbit. Right.
Well, it has an orbit, but it also, within that orbit, it has a right, and that is, and it has a responsibility. That love is the law.
Love under will.
Thank you.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, there's the perfect analogy of the star, that every star has its own trajectory and velocity, as does each human being. So, if I come along in the street and punch you in the face, that's as fucked up as one star colliding into another, and you know that's not right. It's not the way it's supposed to be. So I'm off my orbit if I do that, basically, which is the
right.
most sublime moral law.
Like, I'm Tiamat. Aware. That sounds like Tiamat and Marduk.
Right.
In the potential cataclysm that occurred in the solar system here. So I mean, as above, so below. If it works on the macro, it's going to work on the micro. And that reminds me of the point that you made earlier, bringing up psychoactive compounds. Psychoactive compounds, I think, are a direct link from the micro to the macro. And that's something that you do not see very many people looking at, researching, addressing, and doing creative thinking about.
Yeah.
Psychedelics are a micro conduit to the macro. And that's a big statement. Happened here on your show, man.
I totally agree. That's absolutely true. And that's, I think, you know, there's star stuff, you know. Psilocybin probably traveled here from other galaxies. And due to
it's
the fact that...
Two life forms on this planet that can survive thousands of years in space.
In deep space, right. So, I guess kind of where I wanted to go with the rear end of this show is... How has the trickster archetype been an impetus or catalyst for change, and how might it be in the future, and what can we do, more importantly, what can we do to integrate it into our lives in a constructive and positive and useful manner? It's a loaded question. I know.
Dang, if I could answer that one, boy, I'd be writing another book. I think it really boils down to the individual. You know, we've been so conditioned, you know, in the modern world to kind of ignore certain signals that I think have a direct conduit to the trickster. And one of the most important ones is the incidence of synchronicity or coincidence in our life. I have, since I was a little kid, I have done sort of mini ad hoc on the spot I Chings, or I have requested wisdom. Walking down the street, sitting in my room, playing basketball, I've looked for some form of validation for whatever thought process I was going through, whatever process I was engaged in. And it's almost like the old adage, you know, walk on the crack, break your mother's back, you know, like setting up as an 8 or 10 year old, setting up your walking, so you're walking consistently and seeing when you actually step on a crack.
Right.
Creating these little experiments that are like little mini I Ching, like throwing the coins and getting wisdom. You know, if I make this next shot, I'm going to really do well tomorrow in school, that sort of thing. You know, where you challenge your fate, you challenge synchronicity, you challenge the elements within your four-dimensional reality. height, width, breadth, depth, and time. And you set up challenges that then you get feedback from based on the synchronicity or the coincidental outcome of your challenge. And that is the basic way for people in their everyday lives to get an indication if they're going in the right direction, to get an indication if the energy, the angels, if you will, in the New Age tradition, the angels are in accordance to your will, you know, that sort of thing. So I don't really think that we have, as individuals, very much impact. It is as above, so below. I think if you're really, you're dedicated and exalted in your manifestation, your ability to cause change and conformity to will, if you're really good at that, then boom, you're going to have some impact. But, you know, I think you just have to really always keep transformation as opposed to disaster in your consciousness, your thought. The glass isn't half empty. It's certainly not half empty. It's not half full. We're going to fill it. If you have a positive, changing, always stimulating yourself, having a creative outlet, if you do that in your life and take note of coincidences and synchronicities, that is the most direct way to, I think, positively engage the trickster in your life. How's that?
That's great. You know, it reminds me of, I just reread the Illuminatus trilogy, Fëanor, and there's the big point that he makes in that book that there's basically two types of people, and they're either neophiles or neophobes. And I think the trickster element is kind of the generator of neophilia, which is loving of new things, new ideas, new places, new people, new experiences.
Oh, let me just correct you just slightly, tweak your I agree with you, but let me tweak this. The trickster is the one that converts the neophobes into the neophytes.
Okay, yeah, great. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, one thing I was really thinking about when I was reading your book is that it seems as though there's basically, in the universe and in our own lives, two polarities, and they are chaos and order. And order is basically like the bearded, patriarchal old man in the sky that the...
Saturn.
Or Saturn, right. But the Abrahamic religions and, you know, other religions posited was God, who's as you mentioned earlier, anal retentive and constipated and obsessed with logic and order. And then there's the trickster and chaos. And chaos not as a negative thing, but as an impetus for change and novelty and creativity and spontaneity. And your book just presents that as, you know, as an agent of change, and the type of change that has made us, for better or for worse, beings who walk around with iPods versus stone tools.
Yeah, exactly. And as you were kind of validating my thinking, I had this insight. And you were saying the trickster is chaos and interjecting itself into the static system, basically. And all of a sudden I realized that, hey, if the trickster is evolving, then it is not, it's organized chaos. It's a fractal within chaos. It's chaos becoming patterned and aligned,
right,
which denotes to me organization and possible sentience. So I think as we're moving forward in time, the trickster is less chaos and more a fractal within the chaos. It's chaos that's being directed. And that's where you get into synchronicity and coincidence.
And it seems to me as if, you know, your book, you know, I can't pimp it enough. I mean, it's so much fun to read. But I think it perfectly illustrates the fact that the trickster is basically this phenomenon which we never will be able to, like, herd or put a fence around.
Exactly.
Get our hands
on. It's like herding cats.
Right.
Yeah, by its very design, by its very nature, the role that it plays energetically, it's like breaking open a thermometer and then trying to corral the mercury.
Yeah.
And mercury, Hermes, is the trickster, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, I think it's kind of short-sighted of us to think that we can ever have a chance to corral mercury. I think strategically, the best thing to do would be to learn how the trickster is becoming sentient and self-aware and manifesting itself. And there's certain areas that I really have my feelers tuned to, and that is cybernetic organisms, nanotechnology, the subliminal manipulation of culture vis-a-vis the media and those that control the media, that control the process. We're seeing the tools and methodology of church tourism in a clandestine manner being very effectively used on the great unwashed masses, you know, that 6.5 billion people on the planet that don't have pretty much don't have a clue. So, you know, for those of us that are a little bit more on the ball, I think we would be well advised to keep an eye on certain key pivotal events, especially if they line up in terms of their gematria, their attributional qualities in terms of when the events actually occur, dates, times, that sort of thing. That's when you really start to get an idea, I think, and that idea becomes more solidified if you do your research, that there is definitely a program of parasitic, human-derived, shamanic tricksterism going on at the highest levels on the planet. And the trickster, I would hope, and I would, you know, you know, ideally, the trickster is not going to like that and is going to hand the powers that be the ultimate comeuppance. But I just shudder to think what the ramifications of that are on the rest of us poor, useless eaters, if you know what I mean.
Right.
So, again, we are living the curse and may live in interesting times. I really feel here, I don't prophesize, I don't predict, but man, I've got a sneaking hunch, and I've had it for a long time, that we're heading into some pivotal time period, you know, a very crucial time period in, you know, human history. How do we know it's not evil reptoids coming back to reclaim planet Earth?
Right.
Because they left before the end of the Cretaceous.
Right.
You know, I mean, there's so many things that could be operative here. And I don't factor anything out. I don't factor anything in. I accept all possibility, but I don't believe any of it.
Yeah.
You know, it could be everything. Time travelers, multidimensionals, occultists, ancient knowledge, aliens, crypto-terrestrials from under the oceans or under the ground, you know, Native American thought forms, collective manifestations of cultural stigmata, like the cattle mutilation phenomenon. It could be so complex and involved, and it probably is. The trickster is that unifying force that kind of creates the change all the way through all those weird-ass things I was talking about, you know? So this is really dense subject matter. I really appreciate, you know, the time that that you've devoted to talking with me. It's great to talk to somebody next, you know, in the next room who's actually in Korea. This is real fun for me, so I really do appreciate it.
Well, hey, man. Yeah, I mean, I really appreciate all the years and years you've set aside to investigate all the paranormal phenomena and document it and write books about it, and especially this book, Stalking the Tricksters. And I guess my favorite thing about the book and what you've done is that, well, okay, I'll say, as a preface, like, I've always maintained that in my worldview, I will always have room for the mystery. And I don't ever want to just settle down with any one seemingly sensible explanation for why we're here and what we should be doing and all that. I entertain any and all possibilities and reasons for why we're here and why we should be doing our thing. But
God, I wish more people felt like that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you have to leave room for the mystery, because you're gonna leave your apartment and, you know, maybe find some beautiful woman that wants to hang out with you, or you're gonna get hit by
a bus.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, anything can happen. That's not to say that we're not at the helm of the ship, but you know, we're part of this big process, and your book really does encapsulate all these really heady, interesting topics.
It's dense material. If you can get, you know, I purposely named the first chapter where I define the trickster, chapter zero, because zero is the number of the fool, which is the personification of the trickster in the Western esoteric tradition.
Right.
The joker in playing cards, the fool, which is card zero. So I did this mind-warping chapter zero figuring, if you could get through that chapter, then the rest of the book you're just going to love. And that's, you know, I kind of really, you know, those first 50 pages, it's, you know, it could take you a while to get through some of that stuff because it's so dense. It's not young, it's not old, it's not black, it's not white, it's not positive, it's not negative. It sits at the threshold of the doorway. It's not in the room or out of the room. its process of stepping one way or the other is what makes it important. And that's what the trickster is. It's a liminal force. It's neither here nor there. It's in between. And when it decides to, like, step across the threshold, to change a zero to a one, that incredible spark of energy, of creative energy, creates number one. If zero is the fool or the trickster, number one is the magician. And it's that spark. It's that change from the fool with no agenda to the magician with an agenda. That is what really everything boils down to in our reality.
Yeah, and that's exactly where we are right now. You know, I mean, like, and especially with this whole 2012 thing. You know, like this cliff, or
Y2 2012K.
Right. I need to ingest that into my personal lexicon.
It's really, really important. It's the same exact deal. Definitely, we're in you know, a very the Hopi and Maya would say the end of the fourth world. Well, definitely the Hopi would say that. The Maya don't really say it's the end of anything, but the Hopi say it's the end of the fourth world. So, you know, the important thing to remember is that because time is so short, we need to concentrate our efforts not on converting the unconverted, but maximizing the potential of the people that are already on board with the program. You know, in other words, there's no room in the lifeboat for any more survivors. We need to concentrate on organizing ourselves on the lifeboat. I mean, I hate the sound. You know, it could be a lifeboat that goes into transformation. We don't know, but you got to be prepared for both. And time is nigh. There's not enough time to convert anybody. We just have to organize and be all on the same page, you know, metaphysically within the lifeboat. And that's, you know, it sounds kind of dramatic and almost crass, but that would be a good way, I think, to encapsulate these times.
Well, we live in dramatic and crass times, so.
Yeah, just monitor the earthquakes as they happen around the world every day. I mean, we're seeing a definite, you know, with the Icelandic volcano, with a new rent in the Mid-Atlantic Rift, and we're going to see some stuff up at Katmai very soon. God forbid, you know, the Native Americans in the Pacific Northwest have a saying, and that is when little sister speaks, grandfather, you know, answers. Little sister being Mount St. Helens, grandfather being Mount Rainier. If we ever see anything happen up, you know, in the top part of the, you know, Pacific Cascade subduction zone up there, you know, that's where I grew up. So, you know, I've been in major earthquakes. I've had my world rocked.
Right.
I felt the Alaska earthquake, actually, in 64, or 65. But we are going into a period of upheaval. We have an amazingly powerful early solar maximum period coming up in the next year and a half. We're already seeing the sun was dormant, not one bit of activity for months. And then all of a sudden, boom, we have these big solar prominences and you know, just a dramatic releases of various forms of radiation. You know, everybody's going to look back and say, man, remember the good old days, you know, when we were in recession and the economy was tanking and blah, blah, blah. These are the good old days. And I think we all owe it to ourselves and each other to maximize our potentials, to really be responsible for reading the signals in our lives that could help us be a part of the solution and not continue to be part of the problem.
Exactly. And I think that we get what we... I'm thinking of that Tool song, Ticks and Leeches, from Lateralis. I don't know if you're a Tool fan. But there's a lyric there where he says, this is what you wanted, and this is what you're getting. And I think that we kind of... I think we get what we ask for, and we get what we kind of collectively feel like we want or need. And so whatever catastrophes come and, you know, maybe destroy
us. Transformations, whatever.
But, yeah, I mean, the only thing I as an individual can hope for and try to do is to try to make it, as Bill Hicks said, a better ride.
And yeah, exactly.
The only thing we can do.
Yeah.
Is to try to make it a better ride.
Analogy.
Yeah, whether or not
I really, you know, again, the glass isn't half empty, it's not half full. I'm expecting to sort of have a jet assist into some, you know, exalted form of personal transformation in the next few years. I would really welcome that. I think it would be great for me personally. And I think even if it turns out to be just a really good enema for Western culture. I mean, I think that that would be very cathartic and very...
Yet another Tool reference.
Yeah.
Something needs to be flushed out, and the new needs to begin where the old was cast aside. And
yeah, it's almost like the Quillie of the 20th century, has not manifested yet. He's late. He's like shy or something, you know. We need that tricksterish figure to jerk us out of our complacency and out of our mesmerized pop culture programmed, people reading National Enquirer living populace on this planet. I mean, at least in our hemisphere over here, and I'm not sure if it's quite as bad in Japan or Korea where you are, but man, I'll tell you, the 2 billion Chinese are at some point going to dictate what happens on this planet, and you being there in the East, I'm sure you have probably a better handle on that than I do.
I just went to Beijing in December, man. It was sick. The Great Wall is insane, just as an aside.
But if you can even see it through the pollution.
No, you could. It's majestic. It's probably one of the greatest. I haven't been to the pyramids, but I bet it's one of the most amazing human achievements of all time.
It's the only human achievement that can be seen from space.
Yeah, and I hiked 10 miles of it, and let me tell you, they were up to something crazy at that point in time.
And guess who the people they were trying to keep out ended up becoming? The Dene were chased out of that whole area there.
Oh, wow, okay.
Especially in the West.
So the Dene recently...
They're Mongolians. They were chased out of Mongolia by Genghis Khan. They arrived in the Southwest about 100 years before the Spanish. See, Navajo and the Apache.
That's a trip. That's crazy.
Not many people know that.
Yeah, that's so the Dene
have the same word for the same thing. I think the word for star or moon I think is the same in Tibetan as it is in Dene, and they have very similar cultural peculiarities. There's only two cultures, for instance, on the planet that paint with sand,
right?
That do elaborate sand paintings, and that's the Tibetans and the Navajo. So, the Navajo, they get the Mongolian spot. They're obviously, genetically, they've been proven to be Mongolian. Their hogans that they live in are the same exact dimensions, basically, as the Mongolian yurt, same shape and everything, eight-sided as opposed to round. But
right, and they both have these incredibly colorful rituals and means of dress.
Well, yeah, but the Dene have incorporated the Zuni and Hopi symbology and color schemes. The Tibetans are very, very colorful. Mongolian cultures are very colorful, but they're less stylized, I think. If you go up to the Rezes and see a ceremonial dance up there, you'll see the same vivid colors, but much more stylized, and I think more ancient. When you go to a Hopi home dance, for instance, in July, when those 40 guys come out singing and dancing or regimented stomping, basically, I mean, you can tell you're looking back thousands and thousands of years of a surviving ritualistic tradition. It's very amazing, and the costumes and masks and the other symbology that they utilize in the culture is just very, there's something very powerful and very primal and basic that's going on. You can't put your finger on it, but it really does strike you to the core, and they're waiting for the last of the Hopi prophecies to be fulfilled, and that is one of the dancers in the plaza removing his mask during the dance. It's never happened, and that's the last one, and that's when True White Brother comes back and let the dance begin.
Wow, yeah, man, this has been just absolutely amazing. Okay, so the book is fantastic. It's so well written, so accessible. It's so interesting. It's one of those books like Cosmic Trigger where when I finished it, I was pissed that it wasn't 1,000 pages long. So thank you so much for taking all the time to research this stuff and write all these amazing books about it. And everyone listening should buy it, but... what's coming down the pike for Christopher O'Brien? What's going on?
Well, you know, I'd like to think that, my constant sort of three steps forward, two steps back personal spiritual process will continue. In terms of my research, I'm not in any place, I think, really to attempt to do a quick slam bang, you know, trickster book part two. It's going to take me a couple of years of research, thinking, and a bottle or two of ibuprofen. I do tend to develop headaches when I start getting into some of the more esoteric logic of the whole subject. It does make me think, and that sometimes is not necessarily a good thing. It gives me a headache. But all, you know, joking aside, I plan to do second trickster book, which will, instead of being more of a historical thing and illustrating all the various trickster forms, you know, that I've selected, you know, out of thousands, and it's going to cut to the chase and really be more in lines with our conversation tonight. How we as individuals in this, you know, uncertain times, how we can manifest, you know, the positive elements of tricksterism in our lives, how we can identify it, you know, more of a practical application sort of look at the trickster, and taking my redefinition of the trickster and maybe even coming up with a new name and trying to you know, be, you know, ballsy enough to say, well, the trickster doesn't quite cut it in terms of a definition. We need to expand it and name it something else.
Right.
Trickster in most people's minds is a negative thing. It's something that's like not serious. It's there just to fuck you up. And that's only one part of the trickster. We need a term, a definition. We need something that gives a better sense of what the quote unquote trickster is. But I'm also, you know, I'm working with Clifford Mahudi, who is probably going to be the next governor of Zuni. And I'm going to be working, if he gets in, which it looks like he probably will be, I'm going to be helping him administer a program to train young Zuni to have the tools and the training to document their ceremonies and their rituals before they are lost to the sands of time. They're losing important information, important histories, oral and physical ritual traditions are losing every year. Clifford agrees it's a very important project. I'm going to be really diving in and helping train the kids to be able to have the tools and equipment to document their culture before it disappears. The Hopi and Zuni are the primordial cultures in North America. The Hopi were here first. The Zuni are the younger brothers. They came, you know, probably second world. So, you know, somebody's got to document this stuff. It's like getting a seed bank together, getting all these heirloom seeds and putting them underground to save them in case all hell breaks loose. We need to do that with the cultures on this planet.
Right.
So many cultures are dying. All these wonderful indigenous cultures around the world, they're few and far between, but they're there. They're dying on the vine. We're losing them. We need to get that essential basic knowledge captured and allow them give them the tools and allow them the ability to document their own process.
Absolutely.
I think it's really important.
Absolutely. And Jesus, that sounds amazing. I can't commend you enough for being involved in that work and doing that. That's, you know, I wish I could
let's hope he gets in. And I've got you have a educational program for an Indian kid. Even in these uncertain fiscal times, there is a budget for that sort of vision. So I'm going to help in any way I can Clifford do that for his people. And, you know, gosh, I'll take any of your three listeners, if you want to volunteer, I'm sure I can figure out something for you guys to do, you know.
Yeah, well, please, email me a link or something regarding that, and I'll post it. So.
Sure.
Well, I guess... Jesus, I guess we better wrap this up. I could talk to you for hours about this, but I look forward to all the work that will be coming down the pike from you. And, please do expand upon this trickster phenomenon, because it's indubitably one of the most important things going on right now in our socio-political life and our culture as a globe. And thank you for writing this book that so eloquently expresses what's going on with this trickster guy or girl. It's awesome.
Cool. I appreciate the opportunity to go into elements of my work that there are quite a number of things that I talked about tonight that I've never talked about in all the, you know, dozens of podcasts and radio shows and, you know, and TV appearances, whatever. I haven't had a chance to really feel comfortable enough to go off into, you know, certain areas. So, Andy, it's been great. I really wish your show and everything the best. Be happy to come back anytime. Hey, you know, everybody out there, take care. If the sun don't come up, don't let anybody in.
I have to mention, I was really happy in reading the book to come across a mention of the Saints and Sinners Lounge in Espanola, because I used to buy beer there on my way from Santa Fe to Taos.
Oh, yeah, the Sinners, the Lion Camp, and I think the Pocky Cafe. Boy, that's ground zero for the Pocky Devil, Old Scratch. Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah.
Sinners was like the main place.
Yeah, and you mentioned the bathroom that supposedly Old Scratch or the Devil disappeared into.
Right.
And I took a piss in that bathroom. I remember it distinctly. It was like a supply closet.
Yeah.
They had all these like stacks of Negro Modelo boxes all around, and you had to kind of get your way in there. Okay. Yeah.
Oh, I loved it, you know, getting into research in that whole flurry. I mean, goes all the way back to the 20s, actually. But, you know, that's for another show, dude.
That's for another show, for sure. But I was definitely happy to read about that, because I distinctly remember illegally parking my car in front of that shop and running in to buy a 12-pack and Modelo Especial. I remember the sign. It had, like, the two, like, the angel and the... The devil faces.
And the devil.
Yeah.
Yeah, I went by there more times than I care to remember. I never actually stopped there. I was too afraid.
I love that place. It was great. It was always kind of weird and seedy, because it'd be like, you'd walk in and it was like a beer store, but there'd be all these dudes sitting around this table, and you'd walk in and there'd just be like this hushed silence. And then this one old Mexican dude would, like, kind of help you through buying a 12-pack of beer, and then you'd leave. And I knew as I was puttering away in my piece-of-shit $500 car that they would all be talking about something, like, diabolical or scary, and I loved it. So.
Cool, man.
All right, well, I guess this basically wraps it up. Christopher, thank you so much for coming on the show and writing this fantastic books. And I look forward to speaking with you in the future.
Very good, man.
And thus ends our conversation with Christopher O'Brien, author of many books, including Stalking the Tricksters, Shapeshifters, Skinwalkers, Dark Adepts, and 2012. Panopticon thanks Christopher for writing this amazing book and for taking the time to come on the show. We look forward to what he will be coming up with in the future, and we wish you, dear listener, a delightful evening. Peace.